Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks by the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Christina Henriquez. Christina Henriquez grew up in Delaware, where her novel, The Book of Unknown Americans, is set. She discovered her love of writing in high school when a boy she had a crush on gave her a journal to write her feelings down in. Quote, "For the first few weeks, I was writing to him, spilling my feelings on the page with relish," she recalls. "But it didn't take long before I found I was writing for myself, and for the sheer enjoyment of the act of writing. I was hooked. I sat down at the end of each day and scribbled page after page, experimenting with new ways of saying things and reveling in a feeling of absolute freedom." Though the boy never returned her romantic feelings, Henriquez had found her passion. She went on to earn an undergraduate degree from Northwestern University and her MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. The Book of Unknown Americans explores the lives of several Latin American families who have come to the United States to pursue different versions of the American dream. The novel was chosen as a New York Times notable book, one of the Washington Post's top 50 fiction books, and an NPR great read, among other accolades. Other works by Christina Henriquez include Come Together, Fall Apart, A Novella and Stories, which was a New York Times Editor's Choice selection, and the novel The World and Half. Her work has appeared in a variety of journals and anthologies, and she is the recipient of the Alfredo Cisneros Del Moral Foundation Award, a grant started by Sandra Cisneros. Everybody Reads is a community reading project of Multnomah County Library, made possible in part by gifts to the Library Foundation. The Everybody Reads program celebrates the power of books in creating a stronger community through a shared reading experience. Now, from the 2016 Everybody Reads Lecture, a literary arts special event in partnership with the Multnomah County Library, here is Christina Henriquez speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Hi. Thank you so much to Literary Arts and everyone who made it possible for me to come here and who chose my novel as your Everybody Reads selection this year. I'm really thrilled to be here. I worked on this book for 5 years, and from day to day, I wasn't ever sure if I would actually finish it. And then if I finished it, whether it would actually get published. And then if it got published, whether anyone would actually read it. And then if anyone actually read it, whether they would actually like it. So, to have this kind of audience and this kind of reception is really gratifying. And I can't tell you how much it means to me. So thank you all really for being here. This is my first time to Portland, which is sort of incredible, yeah. I consider myself a little bit of a traveler, but somehow I've never been here. This morning, as you heard, I got to go to Centennial High School, where I met some amazing students who had read my book. And tomorrow, I'll be at Roosevelt High School. And I always love doing those high school events, partly because the students will ask questions that no adults would dare to ask. I was born in Delaware, which is a state that not many people know much about. Sometimes when people ask me why the book is set there, I joke that it's because I know everyone was waiting for the great Delaware novel. My mother grew up there in Newark, and though my father was born and raised in Panama, when he was 18, he applied to school at the University of Delaware, where he hoped to study chemical engineering. He was accepted, and the next thing he knew, he was stuffing a trunk full of everything he could fit in and boarding a plane to the United States. It was the first time he would live outside of Panama. The school, though, mistakenly sent him to JFK Airport in New York City. So after he landed, my father spent his first night in the United States sleeping on the floor of Penn Station, trying to figure out how to get from there to Delaware, and not knowing who to ask. Finally, somehow, he got himself onto a Greyhound bus that took him to the campus. But when he arrived there, he was told that they didn't have any housing for him. Undeterred, he sat in an administrative office for hours, until finally the school was able to find a host family who was willing to take him. The family welcomed him warmly, and because they lived in the kind of neighborhood where the neighbors all sort of knew each other, word spread pretty quickly that he was there. One of the people who heard about his arrival was a girl who lived a few doors down. She had been to Panama the year before as a foreign exchange student. And because of that, her mother urged her to go over and introduce herself. She did. That girl, as you might have guessed, is my mother. She was majoring in Spanish, so my father helped her with her studies. He needed to learn English, so she helped him with that. And before long, they spoke a common language. They fell in love. My father had always assumed that he would come here and earn his degree and return to Panama, where his family lived and where they still live. But my mother changed the course of his life. Because of her, he stayed. The older I get, the more I find I don't believe that we find home in places. I believe that we find it in people. And in my mother, I guess, my father found a new home. My parents married in the mid-70s, and a year and a half later they had me. When they brought me home from the hospital, it was to a small second floor apartment where they became friends with people they still keep in touch with to this day. They bought a house after that, a split level house with a sloped driveway. And we still have videos on Super 98 film, you know, that like wonderful grainy film that's like instant nostalgia, of me riding a big wheel down that driveway and crashing into the garage door with glee. When I was 18 months old, my father's job transferred us to Miami, Florida. And there we lived in a small ranch house with dark wood paneling and geckos that darted out from behind the pictures hanging on the wall. My father was traveling a lot in those days, and my mother was home with me and my brother, who had just been born. She used to make cassette recordings of herself, oral letters, essentially, that she mailed to her parents back in Delaware as a way of keeping in touch. I've listened to those tapes, and you can hear in her voice a certain kind of sadness born of isolation, a loneliness that had taken root. She was living far from her family in a place where she had never been, full of people she didn't know. And then one day, the next door neighbor, a Cuban woman, said hello. And suddenly, my mother had a friend. Just one, but one was enough. When you're alone, bewildered in a new place, a friend can be more than a friend. They can be a life raft. When I was 3, my family and I moved again, this time to Covington, Virginia, where my sister was born. It was an extremely small town, tucked into the Allegheny Mountains. There was a sundry store called Petticoat Junction, where I used to buy gummy worms, and a Kmart, and a Long John Silver's, and not much else. Except, of course, that there were neighbors. Lots of them. Neighbors who showed up at our door to greet my parents with popcorn and beer. Neighbors who at one time had been new to the area, just like us. And we spent a great deal of time in those days hanging out in other people's houses and having people over to ours. Everybody in that town took us in without reservation. My friends were girls with names like Sarah and Sally. Certainly no one else we knew had a last name like ours. No one else had grandparents who visited from Central America and balked at the cold. But I can't remember a single instance of being made to feel that I was different, or that I was strange, or that I was anything less than them. And when I asked my father, who, with his accent and brown skin, might have felt those things even more than me, when I asked him recently about his memory of that time, he said, "I felt very welcomed. We all stayed together." In 3rd grade, my family and I moved to Indiana. where again, no one we knew looked like us. My recollection of that time was that it was a sort of Norman Rockwell experience. My brother and I started a lemonade slushy stand in front of our front yard in the summer. Every year on the 4th of July, all the kids in the neighborhood decorated their bicycles with streamers and flags, and people came out on their front steps to wave at us in our bike parade. It was here that I learned about the American Midwest, and here that I had a teacher, an amazing fourth grade teacher named Gail Artis, who introduced me to books, Tuck Everlasting and Little House on the Prairie, and Johnny Tremaine, and Where the Red Fern Grows, and who, by doing so, sparked what would become a lifelong love affair with reading, which in time, of course, would lead to a love affair with writing. Although, depending on how the work is going from day to day, it's an on-again, off-again affair. She demanded not only that we read books, but that we read them rigorously, in a way that's astonishing to me when I think about it now. Even on weekends, I would read for hours and write reports. And though I resisted it at times, sometimes you just want to go to Dairy Queen with your friends after all, it was formative for me too, and made me appreciate literature in the way no teacher ever had. Because of course, it wasn't just books she was giving me. It was a key that gained me entrance into other worlds and communities different from the ones outside my door. In fifth grade, my family and I moved back to Delaware, where I stayed until I left for college. I earned my undergraduate degree from Northwestern University. After that, I lived in Chicago, in Hyde Park, where I worked for 2 years at the University of Chicago Press, writing catalog copy during the day and writing short stories at night. Because I had had a teacher in college who told us that you don't really know if you're a writer until you're out of school. In other words, you don't know if you're really cut out for it until you have to make your own deadlines and summon your own discipline. And I was bound and determined to prove to the world that I could do that. So I wrote on my lunch break sometimes, and I wrote at night. And my community was the people I worked with and the authors I read, which were, for the first time, contemporary authors, living authors, like George Saunders and Matthew Clam and Joy Williams and Sherman Alexie and Amy Bender. And when I got wind of any of them coming through Chicago to promote their latest books, I would go to bookstores and sit on the floor and wonder. And seeing those authors in person, of course, only made my connection to them feel more real, more immediate. I felt in all those bookstores like I was entering into a league of writers of which I so longed to be a part. After Chicago, I went to graduate school in Iowa. Then my husband and I moved to Dallas, Texas, where I worked in a movie theater, shoveling popcorn and tearing tickets. And between the shows, I would write stories on the back of the day's movie schedule. By the time I was ready to have my first child, my husband and I moved back to Chicago, where we live now. I was able to write this book partly because of my father. The book was inspired by him, and I dedicated it to him. But in large measure, it was because of the experiences I just told you about. Because I have moved around so much in my life, because I am intimately familiar with what it feels like to go somewhere new, to leave so much behind, to start all over again and again. And not only that, but I am the person I am today, I believe, partly because of the communities I found along the way. My family, my school, my teachers, my neighborhoods, my bookcases full of books. I wouldn't have gotten very far without them, for they taught me how to be in the world and how to think. And they trained my attention and expanded it at the same time. Yeah, I've been fortunate over the past year or so to do events all over the country for this book. And at the end of them, people ask me all sorts of questions. The most asked question is, what was the inspiration for the book? And so I tell them about my father, who I just mentioned. I didn't tell his exact story in this book, but it was because of him that I wanted to write the book at all. And what I wanted to tell, mostly, was ordinary stories of immigrants who come to the United States for all different reasons. At the time I was writing the book, I was listening to a lot of news reports, and I started to recognize that there was a certain kind of narrative in our country about immigrants, and in particular about Latino immigrants, and that narrative often had to do with crossing the border, or else it was a narrative that assumed somehow that the majority of immigrants were undocumented, which is another way of saying that it was a narrative that erased people's humanity and instead emphasized only their status: documented, undocumented, legal, illegal. They weren't even people anymore. They were paperwork. So I wanted in this book to recover that sense of humanity. I wanted to push back against the idea of there being one dominant narrative and to write about people. Immigrants, yes, but first and foremost, people. Another question I'm often asked is why I had to write the ending I did. And what I usually tell people is, because I wanted to break your heart. Actually, when my mom finished reading the book, I sent her, well, she called me and she said, "What is wrong with you?" And the thing is that when I read a book, or when I go to a movie, part of what I'm seeking is that emotional connection to the characters or the story. I hear people say sometimes that they read a book because they want to escape, but for me, it's just the opposite. I don't want to escape life. I want to see it. I want to see it in new ways and from new angles and new perspectives. I want to dive deep. That's why I turn to books. And I want, I guess, to give readers that experience too, even if it's painful, especially if it's painful. I want to break your heart. Speaking of that, people love to ask when I knew I wanted to be a writer. And when they ask me that, I tell them that it all began with a boy I liked in high school. We were friends, and he was a skateboarder, and he listened to punk rock, and he was intensely smart. And sometimes during study hall, we would sit and do the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle together. And sometimes we would play Scrabble. And one time he played the word bivouac, which uses all seven letters. And because I was a word nerd even then, I was like, oh my God, I love you. And I would go around sometimes trying to tell him how I felt about him. So we would be at a party at somebody's house, and I would somehow steer him into a corner, and I would say to him, "I really like you." And I would call him late at night after my parents were asleep, and I would tell him, "I really like you." And eventually, he got really sick of this. So he came into school one day with a blank journal that he handed to me. And he said, "Why don't you write down everything you want to say to me for a year and then give this back to me?" And I said, sure. So I took the journal home and I started writing in it. And at first, the entries were really just to him. You know, they were how great he looked in calculus that day, or the hilarious thing he had said in biology. But after about 3 weeks, what happened was that I realized how much I loved just sitting down at the end of every day and writing, just the sheer act of it. And I was always this good girl who followed all the rules, and I was trying to live up to all my parents' expectations. And so I really didn't know until then. You know, I would try to get just as good grade in chemistry as I would get in English. And I didn't know until then that writing might be something that I actually liked doing. And in the journal, I think part of the allure of it was that I could say anything I wanted to say, that I could use all of the language my parents would have killed me for using, that I could be anybody I wanted to be. So I kept writing in the journal for the full year, and I did give it back to him, and he read it, and he thanked me, and nothing happened. But it was okay, because what had happened by then was essentially that I had fallen out of love with the boy, and I had fallen in love with writing. And I really pinpoint that as sort of the turning point for me, and I never looked back after that moment. One of my favorite questions I've ever been asked came from a college student, a boy in Tennessee, who asked me why Maribel had to be beautiful. He wanted to know whether I could please write a book where the girl wasn't beautiful. And there was so much loaded into that question. Acknowledgement of stereotypes and gender constraints, and I told him that he was in luck, because that's the story I'm working on now. The strangest question I've ever been asked was who I thought killed JFK. And then not long ago, I was doing the radio interview, and the host asked me what I thought could be done to make new immigrants feel welcome, to make them feel like a part of the community. And I have to admit, the question kind of stumped me for a second. I really wanted to come up with a very concrete thing to say, a specific action that anyone could take. But what started whirling in my mind at that moment was, what does community really mean? What do we mean when we say that word? And I thought, well, maybe if I can answer that, then it would help me come up with an answer to his question. So what does it mean? Words are tricky. You have a feeling that you know perfectly what one means, but when it comes time to actually pin it down to a definition, it's so hard to do. And so it is with community. I thought I knew what it meant until I started to interrogate my own ideas about it. Maybe, I thought at first, community is just a group of like-minded people. Maybe it's a group of people who have something in common. Or could it be a group of people who live in the same geographical place, who share the same space? Or maybe it has nothing to do with geography and the fact that people live within the same boundaries as each other. Maybe community can be ageographical. Maybe the bonds can be ideological or social or anything else. And what about a feeling of fellowship, a feeling of union with the other members of a community? Wasn't that a requirement too? But on its own, none of those seemed just right. None of them seemed to encompass everything that I instinctively felt about what it means to call something a community. And then I came across this quote by one of my favorite writers, the brilliant Marilyn Robinson. I would say, for the moment, that community, at least community larger than the immediate family, consists very largely of imaginative love for people we do not know or whom we know very slightly. And well, that just about seemed to cover it. Imaginative love, which may be another way of saying empathy, for people we do not know or whom we know very slightly. Although I have to admit that at first it threw me for a loop. How strange, I thought, that community could be comprised of people we don't know or people to whom we have only fragile connections. And yet it was undeniable to me that something about it seemed true. The conventional wisdom, I think, is probably more the opposite. We tend to think of community as being made up of people who have not only one or two things in common, but many things. Think of the communities you're a part of. It might be your school, or the business where you work, or the church you attend, or the street on which you live, or your city. Probably it's many of those and others besides. But in any of them, the more we have in common with the people within that community, the stronger our sense of affiliation with it. It's easy to see ourselves as part of a community when we share so many common bonds. It's easy to understand how we fit in with it, and conversely, how its members fit in with us. On the other hand, the bigger the community and the looser our associations with it, the more work it requires to identify our role in it. But what if, I started to think, one of the greatest myths we have when we consider the idea of community is that the members of a given community must be alike? What if true community can and should not only tolerate difference, but welcome it? What if it's supposed to embrace different perspectives and different characteristics? Which is to say, what if community is supposed to be inclusive rather than exclusive? Difference is part of the beauty, after all. It's much of the beauty of our human experience. And difference, variety, multitude, diversity, however you want to say it, is part of what makes America great. We don't always live up to it, but America, in its ideal, has always been about those things. It has always been about inclusion rather than exclusion. Our better nature says that we should welcome difference rather than be suspicious of it. Because the more closed a community becomes, the more single-minded, the more it's really just a clique, a group of people looking out for their own self-interest. The minute we say to ourselves, well, this person is only 20% like me, but is 80% unlike me, or whatever the ratio might be, we're closing ourselves off to them. We're saying essentially that there must be a threshold that any other person meets that allows them into our club. And the problem, of course, is that there is no such number. There's no number that we could all agree upon across the board, and even if there were, how could you justify such a number? And how could you know for certain whether or not a person meets the criteria without getting to know them? You couldn't. Which means that you're making assumptions about other people. I saw this on Twitter the other day, and I thought it was so great. It's easy to love someone. Get to know them. It's easy to make someone your enemy. Assume you know them. We know this, of course. These are ideas that most of us agree on in theory, but in practice, in our everyday lives, it seems like an idea that we back away from. Too often, it seems to me, sameness is what people are after. And the reason, of course, is that sameness is easier. Sameness coddles us. It makes us feel comfortable and safe. I know this space, it makes us think. I know what to do here and how to behave. I know what's expected. I can just be without having to try very hard. Difference, on the other hand, is disruptive. It challenges us. It requires us to learn something new, or to adapt, or even just to listen. But it asks something. It puts the burden on us. I was watching a speech that President Obama gave recently at a ceremony, welcoming new citizens to the country. And you know, he said a lot of really wonderful things about our history as a nation of immigrants and the echoes of that history today. But one of my favorite parts from that speech was when he was talking about the notion of democracy generally and of being a member of that broad community known as Americans. He said, "The truth is, being an American is hard. Being part of a democratic government is hard. Being a citizen is hard. It is a challenge. It's supposed to be. There's no respite from our ideals. All of us are called to live up to our expectations for ourselves, not just when it's convenient, but when it's inconvenient, when it's tough, when we're afraid. The tension throughout our history between welcoming or rejecting the stranger, it's about more than just immigration. It's about the meaning of America. And of course, America is a community, and it is hard, as I've said, because it asks something of us, because it comes with responsibility. But I would like to argue, precisely because we might not have much in common with another person, precisely because the bonds might seem weak, the potential is greater. Because that sort of community is one forged of a commitment to other people. It's a community that is built, not just a community that occurs. In other words, the bonds exist not simply because you live in the same place as someone else, or because you went to the same school as someone else, or because you work at the same company as someone else, but because you choose, in spite of your differences, to embrace another person, to see them in fellowship with you and you in fellowship with them. You choose. And because you have chosen it, the bond is that much more meaningful. The choice, at its heart, is a choice of seeing. We have to choose to see other people, and not only to see them, but to see them as someone connected to us, not as someone who is different for reasons X, Y, and Z. Let me say that again. The choice is in seeing other people, and in seeing them as connected to us. But how do we do that? How do we change our way of seeing? One way, I'd like to argue, is through stories. You know, every once in a while, someone will read my book and come to an event, and they'll tell me afterwards that the novel made them see other people differently. And that's honestly the highest compliment I can think of getting. But that's the power of stories. They deepen our empathy. They expand it. This is one of the things in particular that fiction does. And it does it through a feat of imagination. Because of words on a page arranged in a particular order, it allows you, the reader, to imagine someone else's life. Think about that. It allows you entrance into a life that you may not have ever conceived of, one to which you might not have paid very much attention ordinarily. A story says, "Here, let me show you this. Here, take a minute to slow down and let me introduce you to this other person. Let me introduce you to this other life. And let me help you imagine what it might be like to live in that life for a little while," which is an amazing thing. This is one of the reasons that stories matter. It's one of the reasons they have always mattered. They bridge us to other people. And in this world, where there is so much talk about walls, and about one wall in particular, my God, if we don't need more bridges. And if you cross over those bridges, if you do it again and again, if you do it enough, if you do it with frequency and with intention, it starts to become reflexive. Imagination is like most things. It's a skill you practice. And the more you practice it, the easier it is to summon. It changes the way your mind works. It changes the way you see other people. Where once your mind harbored fear, which grows too often from a lack of understanding, now you have the impulse for compassion. Where once you had distance, now you have a feeling closer to communion. Where once you had the instinct to hold your community tightly around you, pulling it closed like a cape, now you have the thought to open the wings and let others in. You know now that a person who on the surface doesn't seem to have very much in common with you is also a person who beneath the surface has hopes that you can understand and fears that you can understand, and through reading, you have spent time practicing exactly that understanding. Community is an ever-shifting idea, and the boundaries of any given community are always in flux. Notions of who is to be included are always changing. Sometimes it takes a sea change before we recognize people's right to be included in one community or another. So many of the great struggles throughout history have been, in large part, about that, fighting to be considered and treated as part of something, a fight for inclusion. And there are two ways that that struggle gets realized. In a systematic way, a new law is passed, recognizing people's right to be included in one community or another. But the other level of change is more intimate, more personal. In that way is something that we each, in our own lives, have the power to control. We can choose, each of us, to broaden our ideas of inclusion. And of course, it's a two-way street. Reading doesn't just have the power to change how you see other people, it changes how you see yourself. It lets you see that you are, in fact, more connected to the rest of the world than you thought you were. It allows us to redefine who we are in relation to the rest of the world and in sympathy with it too. And that is so important. Because just as the more we restrict our definitions of who other people are, in other words, the more we use labels and rely on stereotypes and circumscribe other people's humanity, the harder it is to see them as one of us. The more we restrict our definition of who we are, the more it leaves others outside of those boundaries, and the harder it is to see ourselves as one of them. You have to open your eyes at the same time that you open your heart. In America, we're famous for our individualism. It's one of the characteristics that we believe defines us. The idea that each of us as a people stands apart, that we are discrete beings, and that self-reliance is a virtue. In the mythos of America, any of us could ride out into the plains and live in a cabin on our own with nothing but our wits, and we would have achieved something of great value or a life worthy of great respect. But the truth is that we all of us as a people together in this country and all of us as a species together on this planet, whether we like it or not, are dependent upon each other. You can look at the way the economy works, or how disease spreads and how it's controlled, or how innovation occurs, or almost anything to see that that's true. And because it's true, everything, this whole enterprise here on Earth, works a little bit better when we look out for each other, when we take care of each other, and when we foster a sense of responsibility not only to ourselves, but to the people around us. As all of you, I'm sure, are aware, we're in the middle of an election season right now. And the rhetoric at times has been really ugly. I mean, just horrific. And I would say it's deeply un-American. It's the kind of talk that infects people and inflames them. It's the kind of talk that sorts people based on radical generalizations, and generalizations, of course, are the enemy of imagination. They do nothing but reduce people. But all of that, emphasizing our differences from each other, and there are differences, to be sure, but emphasizing them to the point of drowning out any of our commonalities, that's just a way of letting ourselves off the hook. It's a tactic of evasion. It absolves us of feeling any sort of responsibility for each other. It's an ethos that says, well, if we're different, then that's it, isn't it? I don't have to try anymore. If we're different, there's no way to reconcile us. So what's the point of putting in the effort? But that is wrong, and it's damaging, and in very real ways, it's dangerous. But you know all of this. I know you do. The key is to keep reminding yourself of it. Change happens at a molecular level. The subtlest shift can make the biggest difference. So what finally can we do? We can listen. Listen to everyone, but especially to the people who don't usually get to speak. Listen to people's needs, to their wants, to their stories. Listen for the ways that they are like you, and celebrate the ways that they aren't. We can support libraries. Who are among the most important organizations in our communities and whose mission is about inclusion. They aim to serve everyone, and importantly, they often provide outreach to the immigrants in their communities. Here, the Multnomah County Library is doing amazing work. They have a whole unit of their staff dedicated to outreach, I learned, and they've identified targeted languages that are spoken most here in Portland. Those are Russian, Vietnamese, Chinese, Spanish, and Somali. They offer materials and programming in all of those languages, citizenship classes, immigration lawyers, computer classes. They're responding to the needs of the community and reshaping it at the same time. Seek out other community organizations whose mission is the same. Donate your money, volunteer your time. Smile at someone when you pass them on the street. Give people the benefit of the doubt. Don't make assumptions. Choose to see. As Micho Alvarez, a photographer from Mexico and one of the neighbors in the books, says near the end, "When I walk down the street, I don't want people to look at me and see a criminal or someone that they can spit on or beat up. I want them to see a guy who has just as much right to be here as they do, or a guy who works hard, or a guy who loves his family, or a guy who's just trying to do the right things." I was in Ann Arbor a few weeks ago, and a woman there was telling me about her favorite scene in the book. She said, "When Alma and Arturo put Maribel on the school bus and had to just send her off, my heart broke for them. And it brought to mind a school near her where many of the parents didn't speak English. And it made her actually call the school and ask them if there was something she could do to help. And they said, 'Well, do you speak Spanish?' And she answered, 'No, but I speak mother.'" And I loved that. She found the bridge. Find yours. Stay open to the possibility of connection. Don't give in to the lure of disconnection, which can seem so much easier because it requires nothing at all. Though, of course, it steals so much. Your own sense of the complexity and wonder of the world, your hope for it, your sense of your own stake in it. See people as more than their status or their identity. Acknowledge that complexity in other people. Any person is more than an immigrant or a Guatemalan or a Mexican. They are a woman, a knitter, a poet, a person who eats all of the marshmallows out of a box of Lucky Charms, a person who listens to opera, a father who combs his mustache every morning, a teenager who's learning to parallel park, a mother putting her child on the bus for the first time. They are many, many things all at once. All of us are. A novel is always about many things, too. Every once in a while, when I tell someone I wrote a book, they'll say, "Oh, what's it about?" And I swear that's the hardest question to answer. I mean, you would think I'm the author, so of anyone, I would know what it's about. But it's such a tangled web for me. And it's impossible to pick out one succinct description of what it's about. It's a love story. And it's also about what it means to be a parent, the lengths you will go to for your children. It's about belonging and what it means to call a place your home. But usually when I answer the question, what's it about, I say something like, it's about people from all over Latin America who all live in one apartment building together. Which is to say that of all the things the novel is about, the most important to me is the community that it conveys. Because I moved around so much in my life, perhaps, because I never felt completely settled, and even now have trouble believing that I'm going to stay in one place for very long, I'm lured by the idea of community. The most beautiful thing, I thought, would be to put all of these characters together, to imagine a community for them when they needed one so badly, a place where they felt welcomed and where they felt they belonged. And then, at some point, because you can't always be nice to your characters, and in fact, it makes for better storytelling when you're not, I put that in conflict with the world outside their apartment building. A community with people who wanted to cinch their cape tight and keep others out. You see how that turned out. I've been a part of too many communities over my lifetime to count. I told you about a few, but there have been more than that. And every once in a while, you feel yourself fall into the fold of another. I'm a product of all those communities, and in all the ways that they have nourished me and challenged me and helped me grow. And now, here I am, in a new place, among you. And because of a book, because of words on a page that gave rise to an act of imagination, over the past few months, you have all, whether you realized it or not, come together. And now, though we don't know each other, we have a connection. We've built a sort of community. Thank you for that. Thank you for making the choice to read this book and see these characters. Thank you for including me as one of you. Thanks.
That was Christina Henriquez speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2016 as part of the Multnomah County Library Everybody Reads Project. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. Theme music for the Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.